Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll pick up where we left off in the article titled Facing the Past by Joshua Hammer. Four decades after the fall of Argentina's dictatorship, a fight over the country's darkest chapter is reopening grievous wounds. In our last program, we learned more about the death flights, where prisoners were taken from the Naval Academy, ESMA, and then put on a plane and forced out, leading them to fall to their deaths. We'll pick up a little bit before where we left off last week. For years, the known history of the death flights was limited. That finally changed in the 1990s, when a guilt-racked former Navy lieutenant, Adolfo Salengo, broke a pact of silence and confessed his role in the murders to the Argentine journalist Horacio Verbitsky, who told the story in his book, El Vuelo, The Flight, published in 1995. In 2003, Giancarlo Serrato, an Italian photojournalist working in Argentina, became caught up in the story of the Desaparecidos, that's the disappeared. He had come to Buenos Aires to cover an economic crisis, but the brutality of the former dictatorship was in your face, he recalled recently. The mothers were marching, victims were talking, the story was alive. An aviation enthusiast since childhood, when a pilot friend of his father's would fly him over Rome in a single-engine Cessna, Serrato believed that tracking down the death planes might provide the key to finding those involved in the murders. Argentina's armed forces only had about 15 planes, and not so many pilots, he told me. Serrato credits his Roman upbringing with teaching him to value the history embedded in inanimate objects. When I saw stones as a child, I thought, this stone reveals things about the Roman Empire. The object for me has a soul. A colleague gave Serrato a copy of the little-noticed follow-up memoir written by Salengo that contained a vital clue. The former Navy lieutenant identified the principal model of the plane used in death flights, a clunky but durable British-made aircraft known as the short SC-7 Skyvan, nicknamed the Flying Shoebox. Serrato spent the next few years shuttling between his home in Italy and assignments across South America, returning frequently to Argentina to shoot portraits of the mothers of Plaza de Mayo and victims of the junta. Every year I got more deeply inside the story, he said. In 2007, a colleague introduced him to Lewin, who was a released prisoner who had survived basically not going to on a death flight. And the two picked up the quest for the planes in earnest. An extensive online search turned up the serial numbers of several short SC-7 Skyvans used by the Argentine Navy and Coast Guard in the 1970s. Other sites compiled by aviation aficionados tracked the plane's ownership history. Two short Skyvans had been lost, probably shot down and destroyed during the Falklands War. The Argentine military had sold another Skyvan to a skydiving company in Luxembourg, but the company's owner refused to provide any more information about his plane, so Lewin and Serrato kept looking. Soon they traced another Skyvan to a private American mail carrier, GB Airlink, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. In 2009, the owner of GB Airlink shared with Lewin and Serrato a critical document, the plane's flight logs. Dating to 1971, when the plane, then registered as PA-51, was originally purchased by the Argentine Coast Guard, the logs contained records of every flight the plane had made in four decades. Each maintenance operation, every problem, every flight had to be recorded, Lewin says. You cannot sell a plane without it. To make sense of the logs, Serrato and Lewin enlisted the help of a commercial pilot in Argentina who, cooperating in secret for fear of repercussions, singled out a number of suspicious flights from the mid and late 1970s. In each flight, the short Skyvan had taken off from a regional airport 5 miles from ESMA, detention center on a Wednesday evening. It had flown for nearly 4 hours and returned to the same airport without making any other stops. The long journey, close to the plane's maximum range, raised the pilot's eyebrows. According to standard aviation practice, planes should never use more than 75% of their fuel on any flight, and military pilots were known for their strict adherence to the rules. But this plane, the airman told Serrato and Lewin, was basically running on fumes. He theorized that the military pilots had pushed the plane to reach the Atlantic Ocean, a 300-mile trip where bodies could be disposed of without a trace. But he refused to put his theory on tape or sign an affidavit. Most of his fellow commercial pilots were ex-military men, he explained to them. They would kill me if I did, he said to Lewin. Finally, in 2010, Lewin and Serrato turned to Enrique Pinheiro, and prominent Italian-Argentine ex-airline pilot turned actor, film director, and political activist, who felt he had little to fear from a discredited military. One date in the flight logs leapt out of Pinheiro, December 14, 1977. 6 nights earlier, the leaders of the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo and other relatives of Desaparecidos had gathered to plan strategy at a church in Buenos Aires. One group member, who had introduced himself as the brother of a missing leftist and was affectionately known as the Little Blonde, was in fact an undercover naval officer named Alfredo Astiz. He later became known as the Angel of Death. As the meeting broke up, Astiz singled out 12 activists with a telltale kiss on the cheek, including three mothers and two French activist nuns. Over the next 2 days, plainclothes officers arrested each of them and transported them to ESMA. Task Force torturers beat and administered electric shocks to the women for nearly a week. They made the nuns pose before a Montaneros banner and released it as evidence that the guerrillas had kidnapped them. ESMA survivors would recall seeing the women at the center on December 14th. A few days later, after a night of storms and heavy waves, 5 corpses washed up on the coast. Workers hastily buried them in a local cemetery. It wasn't until July 2005 that forensics researchers exhumed the remains. DNA analysis identified 1 French nun and 3 mothers. The 5th body was not identified, and the remains of the 2nd nun were never found. Pinheiro, poring over the logs, saw that on December 14th, the Skyvan flew for 3 hours and 10 minutes, making no stops before returning to base. And the log contained other information, the names of the flight's 3 Coast Guard pilots. They were Mario Daniel Aru, Alejandro Domingo D'Agostino, and Enrique de St. George. Lewin, investigating further, found the pilots were still working in commercial routes, Madrid, Miami, and Rome. She told me, realizing this, she was overcome by surprise and horror. Within a year, thanks to their investigation, the pilots were arrested and charged with crimes against humanity. Around the same time, Argentine prosecutors were building a larger case that would, unfolding the next 5 years, expose the inner workings of the entire torture and murder apparatus in ESMA. First ESMA trial had taken place in 2007, after years of delays, with a single defendant who died before a verdict could be handed down. A second trial in 2009 had ended with 16 convictions and 2 acquittals. The so-called ESMA mega case, the largest trial in Argentina's history, opened in Buenos Aires in 2012. The trial of 54 defendants took testimony about 789 individual crimes from around 900 witnesses and presented new details about the death flights, including the complicity of church officials, who sometimes blessed the pilots before their flights. It also revealed how ESMA was used at times as a clandestine maternity ward for pregnant detainees who were then killed and whose newborns were illegally adopted. In the course of the trial, prosecutors presented powerful evidence against the 3 pilots identified by Serrato and Lewin as responsible for the murders of the French nuns and the members of the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo on December 14, 1977. The defense didn't dispute that the 3 men had flown the plane, but it argued that pilots, isolated in their cockpit, were unaware of the horror unfolding in the rear. Prosecutors countered that it would have been impossible for them not to be in on the executions. Before lowering the ramp mid-flight, the operator in the back had to signal the pilots so they could decelerate to about 140 miles per hour or risk structural damage, even the plane's destruction. Moreover, as the ramp winched open, the pilots would have experienced a sudden drop in temperature and heard a deafening roar above the whine of the Skyvan's engines. In 2017, judges found two of the pilots guilty of crimes against humanity and sentenced them to life in prison. The third had died in prison while awaiting trial. When it was over, the ESMA mega case resulted in 48 guilty verdicts. 29 people received life sentences, and 19 others were sentenced to between 8 and 25 years in prison. In the trial's closing remarks, the prosecutors called Vera Yarek, a founding member of the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, who spoke of the importance not only of seeking justice for the victims, but also of documenting and remembering the atrocities for posterity. Jarek was an Italian-born Jew who fled to Argentina with most of her family in 1939. Her grandfather, who stayed behind, was murdered at Auschwitz. In 1976, Jarek's 18-year-old daughter, Franca, was abducted by the dictatorship and was never seen again. We know the truth. Justice and memory are the best guarantees for nunca más. Never again, Jarek said. With our efforts to promote memory, we try to ensure that these tragedies don't fall into oblivion, and on the contrary, that they allow us to recognize symptoms of repetition, since history teaches us that what happened once, unfortunately, can happen again. It was in that spirit that immediately after the trial, Lewin, Serrado, victims' families, and the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo began pressuring the government to acquire the Skyvan and bring it home for display at the ESMA Memorial Center. We always thought the plane had to be in Argentina, Lewin told me. It's iconic. It's important to the new generation. But the president at the time, Mauricio Macri, had other priorities and dragged his feet on trying to arrange a handover. In 2019, the plane was sold to Wynn Aviation, a commercial air contractor based in DeKalb, Illinois. The company was not aware of the aircraft's history. Not long afterward, following a personal appeal from the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, the government of Macri's successor, Alberto Fernandez, struck a deal to purchase the plane. Then the COVID-19 pandemic put everything on hold. It would be 3 years before there was any new movement. At last, on the morning of June 3, 2023, Ivan Blusky, an Argentine pilot with Wynn Aviation, climbed into the cockpit of the former death plane. Two newly installed ferry tanks nearly doubled the plane's fuel capacity, but the journey from Illinois to Buenos Aires would require at least 10 stops. Blusky and his co-pilot landed first in Arkansas, where they picked up non-working replicas of the short Skyvan's original propellers and engine to be retrofitted in Buenos Aires for display. Over Jamaica, an oil leak caused a turbine to overheat, nearly resulting in a catastrophic engine failure. The pilots had to ground the plane near Kingston for 13 days as they waited for a new engine to arrive from the United States and performed tests to make sure the plane was fit to fly. Next, they crossed the Caribbean to Barranquilla, Colombia, and soared over the Andes, huddling in their frigid, unpressurized cabin at 16,000 feet, while keeping a close watch for ice accumulating on the wings. They stopped on a jungle strip in Leticia, in the Colombian Amazon, touched down in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, then landed in Tucumán in northwest Argentina. On June 24th, 3 weeks after the Skyvan set out on its 6,000-mile odyssey, Blusky guided the plane through thick winter fog as it approached Jorge Newbery Regional Airport in Buenos Aires. Serrado stood on the runway alongside Lewin, leaders of the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, and dozens of family members of death flight victims whose final journeys had started at this spot. As the ghostly outline of the Skyvan emerged through the mist, Serrado recalled, he drew a breath. I had come up with this idea nearly 20 years before, and now I saw this aircraft landing in Buenos Aires, it told me. I moved away to stand alone, and for the first time I cried. The Malay government swept into office that December. Villarruel, the vice president, has continued to argue that leftist guerrillas bore primary responsibility for the violence that convulsed Argentina. And she routinely disputes that 30,000 people were killed by the regime. While human rights groups said guerrilla violence likely killed hundreds or possibly more than 1,000 people, They argue these figures include soldiers killed during armed confrontations and can't be equated with the many thousands of non-combatants known to have been killed by the junta. In a sign of how fractious this debate has become, last March, on the 48th anniversary of the coup, tens of thousands of protesters in Buenos Aires carried signs reading not only Nunca Más, but also They Are 30,000, an apparent challenge to the new government line. Villarruel declined my request for an interview, and a spokesperson wrote in an email that, for the moment, she's not interested in speaking about the subject. Malay's office did not respond to my request for a comment. One of Villarruel's frequent targets of criticism is Miriam Lewin, whose journalistic exposés, public condemnation of the government, and high-profile efforts to bring back the Sky Van have made her a symbol of the movement to honor Argentina's historical memory. Villarruel has needled Lewin by referring to her as Penny or Polaca, misleadingly conflating Lewin, as her captors did, with the nom de guerre of guerrillas. During my torture, the men of the Air Force kept asking me if I was Penny or La Polaca, Lewin explained. In one of several posts on X, formerly Twitter, attacking Lewin, Villarruel cited Lewin's incarceration at ESMA as apparent proof of her quote-unquote terrorist activities. In fact, Villarruel has called for dismantling of the ESMA Memorial Center itself. She proposes turning it into a school, she has said, so it can be enjoyed by all the Argentine people. She has shepherded funding cuts to other former torture centers that are now memorial sites, arguing that they present a biased perspective by ignoring the alleged crimes committed by those detained there. I visited one such site, known as El Vesubio, where I met Veronica Castilli, the caretaker. During the dictatorship, Villarruel's uncle, Ernesto Villarruel, was an intelligence officer supervising El Vesubio. He was later arrested and charged with crimes in connection with the role, but he was never tried, and he was released in 2016 because of poor health. Castelli was 2 years old in 1977 when her parents were kidnapped and taken to El Vesubio. Her mother was 6 months pregnant, and Castelli never saw either parent again. Castelli was raised by an uncle, and she only learned about a younger sibling, a sister born while her mother was in captivity and then appropriated in 2008. That's when a decades-long investigation turned up the name of a Buenos Aires woman, then 31 years old, in the files of the Christian Family Movement, a Catholic organization with ties to the junta that acted as an intermediary in illegal adoptions. DNA testing confirmed that she was Castelli's younger sister. Castelli opened a padlocked gate and led me across a field past three stone pillars marked Memory, Truth, and Justice. The grounds had once contained officers' quarters, prison cells, and a torture chamber known as Room Q for Quebrada, broken in reference to prisoners' spirits. But that was all that was left were their stone foundations. Since the government cut funding, Castelli told me, she has paid for the site's upkeep herself. The government has sold off other public sites of memory, including part of La Perla, a former torture and execution center in the city of Cordoba, and an old army infantry headquarters in the province of Corrientes. Other programs are losing critical government support. For decades, the grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo have been instrumental in the search for adopted children, amassing a vast database about suspected adoptees compiled from anonymous tips, suspicious neighbors, relatives of the disappeared, and other sources. Since the late 1980s, the government has also overseen a genetic database containing DNA from family members of desaparecidos known to have been pregnant at the time of their abductions. And during the Kirchner years, it established a special investigation unit as part of the National Commission for the Right to Identity, which granted the grandmothers access to old military files. Last July, the Milei government eliminated the special unit, arguing that it violated the country's constitution by usurping prosecutorial powers and intruding on the right to privacy of security officers. Guillermo Perez Roisenblit, an adoptee who learned his true identity in 2000 and now works to find other appropriated children, told me the unit was essential in helping the grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo pursue its investigations. This has made things more difficult, he admitted. The administration has also shuttered a special Justice Department office that investigated dictatorship-era crimes, Lewin told me. The government is ruling by decree, dismantling all public entities related to human rights. At ESMA, after touring the main building, I walked across the tranquil campus until I reached an asphalt plaza near the main gate. Directly in front of me, protected by a low metal barrier, was the boxy gray Snubnose propeller plane, with five passenger windows to the side and a rear ramp. The very aircraft from which government killers had thrown their perceived enemies thousands of feet to their deaths. The Skyvan was finally installed as a permanent exhibit at ESMA in late June 2023. Circling it, I found it hard to equate this clumsy-looking aircraft with a program of state-sponsored homicide, but the plane's very modesty made it all the more indelible as a symbol of brutality. When I met with Meiki Gorosito, the ESMA Memorial Sites director, she conceded that the past year had been difficult. "I cannot say that we don't have problems," she said. But she stressed that for many Argentines, the battle for memory, truth, and justice has never felt so urgent. It's a dangerous moment when the government of a country doesn't condemn crimes against humanity. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section, the National Treasure, titled Bold Type by Stephen Kurse. On her beloved typewriters, Octavia Butler tapped out a prescient course for science fiction. Octavia E. Butler didn't like to wait for inspiration. In fact, the celebrated science fiction author denounced the idea of waiting for one's muse. Habit is more dependable, she advised. The storyteller's proclivity to testament is testament to her diligent, lifelong writing habit. Over her 35-year career, Butler used the fantastical narratives of science fiction to explore the complexities and cruelties of survival. Among other things, by placing Black people at the center of her stories, she boldly defied the ways of her beloved but often conservative genre. "I wrote myself in," she once said. Her tales of power-hungry telepaths and erotic alien encounters are now canonical in her science fiction and beyond. The prescience of her parable books, which feature environmental disasters and a leader who wants to, quote-unquote, make America great again, have been especially praised. Even today, says Jerry Canavan, author of a 2016 Butler biography, it just feels like she predicts the future. Born an only child in Pasadena, California, in 1947, Butler grew up poor, raised by her mother and grandmother. Her father, a shoe shiner, died when she was three. Her mother, a day laborer who had to leave school at age 10 to work, cleaned houses under the demeaning conditions of the Jim Crow era. Butler sometimes accompanied her mom on the job, where they were required to enter homes through back doors. Writing became a way of escaping those circumstances. "Their lives seemed so terrible to me at times, so devoid of joy or reward," Butler said of her mother's and grandmother's service jobs. "I needed my fantasies to shield me from their world." She first put her ideas to paper as a 10-year-old, scrawling stories of magical horses in notebooks, and later pecking away on a typewriter she begged her mom to purchase. She began submitting the stories to science fiction magazines in 1960, amassing rejections until 1970 when she sold her first tale, Child Finder, a story about a telepath working to help psychic children. Throughout her years of obscurity, Butler rose daily to write before menial jobs as a potato chip inspector, dishwasher, and telemarketer. She also jotted down ideas while crisscrossing Los Angeles on public buses, using the people she observed to plot potential characters and scenarios. 12 published novels and 2 short story collections resulted from this steadfast dedication. Butler found her stride after publishing her debut novel, Pattern Master, in 1976, producing a book a year until 1980. Mainstream success largely eluded her over the following decade, though she won multiple Hugo and Nebula Awards, the highest honors in science fiction. While her output began to slow, her reputation grew, and in 1995, she became the first science fiction author to win a prestigious MacArthur grant. Her stories often challenge the basic premises of classic sci-fi, imagining, for example, the ways humans might submit to alien captors rather than resist them. In books such as Dawn and Kindred, Butler shows the ways that gender, race, and sexuality informs visions of the future and past. A writing habit that began as a means of escaping her present became a way of revealing its secrets. Butler did much of this imagineering on typewriters. Her first model was a portable Remington, her second a gift from her early mentor, the larger-than-life science fiction author and editor Harlan Ellison. Several, sadly, were stolen from her home in Los Angeles over the years. She donated one of her well-loved typewriters, the trapezoidal Olivetti Studio 46, painted a cool powder blue, to the Anacostia Community Museum for its 2003-2004 All the Stories Are True exhibition, which celebrated Black American literature. At the time she donated this machine, Butler was widely revered as one of the architects of Afrofuturism. 2 years after the exhibition, Butler died at the age of 58. Even in Butler's most difficult moments, such as the death of her mother in 1996, her habit kept going. Major tragedies in life, there's just no compensation, she told the Los Angeles Times in 1998 while promoting her novel, Parable of the Talents. The story you see will get you through. Next, we'll move on to a prologue article about art titled Feast Your Eyes by Amy Crawford. In food, the Impressionists found a rich and satisfying subject matter. France has long derived a portion of its national pride from its culinary sophistication. But during the late 19th century, a time of war and social upheaval, as well as the cultural flowering of the Belle Époque, the issue of food could sometimes be fraught. Aristocrats feasted while peasants toiled and poor Parisians starved, and new delicacies like the banana debuted against a backdrop of imperialist adventures. To artists like Claude Monet and Paul Gauguin, all of it was also rich fodder for a new approach to painting, showcased in the play of light over a silver pitcher with the slimy floors of a bustling fish market. This is as much a social history as it is the story of food, says Mark Scala, chief curator at the Frist Art Museum in Nashville, which in late January will host the traveling exhibition Farm to Table, featuring some 50 Impressionist canvases and sculptures that depict markets, gardens, farmers, and gastronomies, abundance, and penury. Food, the universal human obsession, connects people from all walks of life, Scala notes, making it a portal through which artists and museum goers can explore not only human appetites, but also darker questions of class, conflict, and conquest. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.